Welcome to Political Rewind, the end of a long and very busy week politically. So we have a lot to talk about today. Not that there are many days these days that we don't have a lot to talk about. Joining me in the studio, as he does on Mondays and Fridays, Jim Galloway, the political writer, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him in the Thursday and Sunday paper. What are you writing for Sunday?
Well, we got Casey Cagle saying he wants to be the guy to bring broadband to rural Georgia with a sidebar on the adoption bill.
Clearly, broadband is going to be a big issue in this
governor's race. It's going to be huge. It's going to be
rural broadband. And Jim, as long as you're talking, we want to give you a chance to mention the AJC has just launched a new political. Tell us about
politically
what you're doing.
Georgia.
PoliticallyGeorgia.com.
Yeah. PoliticallyGeorgia.com, and it will cost you eventually $3.99 a month. We're going behind the payroll wall.
Behind the paywall.
I'm worth it, I think.
Dr. Andre Gillespie, we haven't seen you in way too long. What the heck have you been doing lately?
Trying to get ready for school.
Oh, I'll bet that's right. You said classes started at Emory, of course.
Did you get your picture taken by the mailbox this year?
No.
You know, the first year of every year, first day of school?
Yeah, no.
Oh.
Yeah, no.
Andre, of course, political science professor at Emory University. Todd Rehm, Republican consultant and editor
of
GeorgiaPundit.com, which is available. It is not behind a paywall. Who knows how many people you'll pick up when he goes behind the paywall over at the AJC, Todd. and Howard Franklin is back with us. We haven't seen you in a while
either. Far too long. Glad to be back.
Howard is a Democratic political strategist, and also we use the word lobbyist in state government.
It's not a dirty word.
Are you starting to gear up?
Government affairs specialist.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah. All right, let's start with all the things we have to dig into today. I want to start with a little bit of breaking news. The Financial Times today, this is not the breaking news aspect of it, but Gary Cohn, who's one of the president's senior advisors, economic advisors in the White House, did an interview with Financial Times. He's one of the Jewish members of the senior staff, and he was asked how he felt about Trump in Charlottesville, and he was very candid. He said basically that the president must do better in consistently condemning hate groups. He said that he had seriously considered resigning and even drafted a letter of resignation. And he is quoted as he says, quote, "I also feel compelled to voice my distress over the events of the past 2 weeks." So that's powerful enough. Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, another Jewish member of the Trump team, was in the briefing room just a short time ago, and he was there to talk about new economic sanctions against Venezuela. But the one of the members of the press corps asked him how he felt about Gary Cohn's remarks and how he, Mnuchin, as a member of a Jewish member of the staff, felt himself.
But did you feel the same pressure that Gary Cohn said he felt to resign?
Well, let me first comment. I think, you know, I put out an extensive statement earlier last week on my view of the situation. I think there's no question that the president was not equating the hate groups with the people who were peacefully, and under no circumstances was I going to resign. Gary and I have known each other for 20 years. I can tell you I'm speaking to him every day. His number one focus is absolutely working on tax reform with me and getting tax reform done. And Gary's committed to be here and couldn't be more excited about that.
So we have probably by now talked the Charlottesville story into the ground. Nevertheless, I find it interesting, Jim and all of you weigh in, the way in which various members of the administration are dealing with it. You know, you got Gary Cohn saying I was on the verge of resigning, Mnuchin giving the president cover. It might be helpful if they all got together and figured out a way to get on the same page about it.
Yeah, you think they would. But the problem is that, of course, the flaw in that tactic is you've got a president who keeps saying stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, when he was in Phoenix on Tuesday, and he kind of rattled off the groups that he's supposed to oppose, like they're some sort of like a just kind of something written on a laundry
list. We got them. Yeah,
on a laundry list. That does not help your cause.
Not at all.
All right, Andra.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's nice to hear that there was some moral conflict. And so I appreciate the fact that Gary Cohn, you know, expressed moral conflict. I mean, there are going to be some people, myself included, who, you know, were waiting for people to quit in protest to send a message, because I think we're all trying to figure out what will it take to get President Trump to be consistent and to change his behavior. And it probably might be some shock to the system. You know, I think a lot of people are still waiting to hear what Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, you know, are going to do, because, you know, they've come out. You know, and Ivanka in particular, you know, has, you know, openly said that, you know, they oppose, you know, anti-Semitism, and clearly that would be something that's important to them. But I think there is this issue of, well, what kind of moral suasion are they able to leverage on their father to get them to get him to change? And so, you know, it might take something drastic as somebody actually seriously quitting and being like, I'm quitting because, like, your stance against bigotry is not clear.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it also reflects a breakdown in the norms of government service, where for many years it's been part of taking the job that you're not going to publicly say something that contradicts what your president or your senator, whomever your principal is. But the problem with that is that the president, it's hard to say something that doesn't contradict something he's said, number one. But he's also giving this example of not playing by the old norms of government service. And so, you know, you've got to feel a little bit more free to speak in front of a microphone. When I, you know, people of my age, folks who grew up sort of in and out of and around government, are used to being much more circumspect. That's not the case in Washington anymore.
Boy, it sure isn't. It sure isn't. Did you want to weigh in?
Well,
no,
all
we
I'd
move
say
on?
Is just to add to what Todd said is, I mean, the problem is, in the past we've had political figures who have operated within the guardrails. You know, they might move over to the right, over to the left. They may drive on the center line, but they're always in the guard between the guardrails.
And there's been a sense that it's important to be consistent, and to one of the things that I find amusing is folks taking something the president says today and talking about how that's going to play out in 6 or 9 months. And in the way it used to work, you might signal a change in policy 6 to 9 months out and gradually move over to that lane, as Jim said. Today, the president may have forgotten what he said 6 minutes ago.
I would just add that... Yes, the president's a different type of politician, if we can call him that. But I think he's also attracted a different type of operative to the White House, people who don't have that discipline, people who don't intend to make a career out of public service, and who couldn't care less about, you know, what's said from one day to the next. So I think this lack of discipline is actually coming from the top down, but it's spreading.
And sometimes they seem to be in a race to see who can have the shortest career in public service.
Andre, we'll give you the last word on this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think in this particular instance, the reason why it's nice to hear somebody at least say something, even if I would have pushed for them to go harder, was that, you know, this was personal, like, for a lot of people. And for somebody, you know, who shares an identity that gets attacked by, you know, the Klan, that was personal. I mean, and for me, it's not just that I have an identity that the Klan doesn't like. It's also that I used to live where that Tiki Torch rally happened.
Oh, yeah.
Like, literally, that was my bedroom door they walked by. Wow. And so, like, that, like, somebody has to stand up and say something.
Yeah. All right. Let's. There's another breaking story today. We know that Stacey Abrams, who's been the minority leader in the Georgia House, has declared she's already an announced candidate for governor. And, you know, Jim, just the other day we were talking about the fact that nobody had resigned who's running for statewide office. Well, Stacey Abrams today announced she is stepping down from her seat in the legislature to devote herself full time to running for governor. And there was a line in her letter to the governor, letter of resignation, that I thought tells us something about what we kind of expected, what she's running on. She said, "I appreciate our collaborative work to serve kinship family, to pursue criminal justice reform, preserve pre-K, to invest in public transit, and a few other issues as well. It, you know, she's signaling some of the issues, of course, that she'll take on as a candidate.
Right. I think this has a lot to do with the fact that money is going to be a very important issue on the Democratic side, access to money this year. And of course, as soon as the session begins, if you're holding office, you cannot raise any money.
Right.
That's right. And I think that, to Jim's point, I think two things. One, leave it to a Democrat to set the pace. I think you'll see a lot of Republicans who've announced themselves as gubernatorial candidates and a couple who are rumored to also potentially avoid the session. But then two, you've got a much more crowded Republican primary than we might have expected, let's say, 6 or 9 or 12 months ago. So I expect a couple of those guys to also decide, both for governor and lieutenant governor, they'd be better served raising money than being.
Right now, we're not hearing that. We're hearing there that they're in it to stay.
I believe that now. I think give it 4 months, I think it'll change.
Well, the secretary, Brian Kemp, there's no incentive. I guess he can raise money, but he also has power. No?
No, what? I don't think so. I don't think he
Constitutional
can.
No. I'm saying if he were to resign, he could raise money.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But he has a certain amount of leverage in a statewide constitutional office as Secretary of State, in the same way that Casey Cagle, as lieutenant governor, may give up a few months of fundraising, but he has the power of being the president of the Senate to deal with his agenda.
And the things that attend being Secretary of State or lieutenant governor are much greater than what a state representative gets.
Yeah, exactly.
There are benefits.
I would disagree a little bit there. I think, I don't know what Brian Kemp's necessarily his legislative agenda is, but I think his bully pulpit's a great deal smaller than the guy who presides over the Senate every legislative day. I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity for Brian Kemp to catch up on fundraising and to really go out and push his values tour in a way he doesn't need the bully pulpit for.
Andra, I happened, by coincidence, I ran into Stacey Evans, who is Abrams' opponent, at breakfast this morning down the street from GPB. And we talked briefly, and I said, boy, this has gotten more intense quickly than you probably expected, right? And she said, yeah, this race is on the Democratic side in terms of Abrams and Evans.
I'm not surprised that it's intense this soon. You know, Democrats have a lot to prove in this race. They've, you know, been making signals to the National Party about how competitive the state is. And then you've got this sort of fight for the soul of the party and who, you know, will best represent the party. And so it's not surprising that this would happen. It's also not surprising, I will say, as somebody who was represented by Stacey Abrams, that she was going to quit because her opponents are already out there campaigning, and campaigning, you know, actively. So, not her opponents, but her successors,
yeah, her
I should say.
The people who want to run for that seat.
Well, and this is filtering down to other levels as well, where we're seeing people start their campaigns for 2018 for state House and state Senate today. And for those like Howard and myself who make a living doing campaigns, that off year no longer exists.
Let's turn. We got plenty of time. We'll talk about the governor's race in great depth. Let's turn to a big event, Jim, that's coming up in this state on Monday. As I said in the opening of the show, almost half a century after the assassination of Dr. King, the state of Georgia is honoring him now with a statue that will be unveiled on the grounds of the state capitol on Monday. Where exactly is that statue going to stand?
That's on the northeast corner.
What does that mean?
It's kind of, you know, the smokestack, the big Corey smokestack that's out there.
On
the highway side, it'll be just pretty much looking right at it, right across catty corner from the Sloppy
Floyd
building.
So kind of looking toward Auburn Avenue in the neighborhood where he grew up.
Yeah, and I think there may be the purpose may be to have him looking at Ebenezer. Looking toward Ebenezer at that point.
Ebenezer Baptist Church.
Yeah, it's 49 years and 4 months.
Yeah.
And it's coming at a time we are putting the first, this is going to be the first African-American, the statue of an African-American on the state capitol grounds. And that's happening as, of course, we've got this debate over in Charlottesville about taking Robert E. Lee down.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about that in a minute, but would you wrote a really fine column about what would you like to see? What do you think we should hear from speakers, particularly Governor Deal, on Monday morning. Our Sam Whitehead will be there reporting it for us, and he'll join us on Political Rewind later, so we'll find out for certain then. But tell us a little bit about what the point you were trying to make in your column.
Well,
was.
I mean, basically what this is a again, it's long overdue, but it is a decision by a Republican governor that if we're going to have a shared history, we have to have a shared space. You have to share your public spaces. You can't assign them exclusively to this group or that group. You have to have, in order to have a shared history, you've got to recognize the same past, the same icons, if you will. And it has, to me, it has, given what else he did this week, which is appoint DeKalb County CEO Michael Thurman to the state Stone Mountain Memorial Association. He's the only black member on there now. It speaks to that situation as well. That's Stone Mountain is a situation where physical space needs to be shared. History needs to be shared.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Andra, I think a different way of kind of saying the same thing that Jim did in his column was said by Roy Barnes, who wrote an essay about all this this week. The AJC ran it. And what Barnes at one point in it, I forgot to print it out and bring it here, but I can paraphrase. He said every time he's passed by monuments, tributes to the Confederacy, he's thought, where are the monuments to the enslaved people who also have a share in the history of that period of time? And I think in a way, Jim is making a similar comparison.
Yeah, I mean, you know, right now, I think things are very, very heated and very, very emotional. But these debates have been going on for years.
Yeah.
What people are arguing over is, one, do these Confederate monuments stand up as a symbol of hate? And there are people who would argue no. And I would argue if you read the monuments, a lot of them say yes. And then sort of what do we do? So if you take down these monuments, is that going to make us forget the Civil War, forget the antebellum period, and forget kind of how we've gotten to the place that we are? And I don't think anybody reasonably is going to argue that we start to erase our history and forget what happened, even though I think we have to acknowledge that, in a lot of the United States, this part of the country included, people's understanding of the Civil War, the causes of the Civil War, the long-term impact of the Civil War are spotty at best. But it's a question of, does keeping up that monument actually help educate people? And it's not clear, especially in the last 2 weeks, that that's the case. And does it make sense to honor certain people? So if you've got a school named after Nathan Bedford Forrest. Or you have a statue just there to honor Stonewall Jackson without any context. Is that honoring him, or is that actually teaching anybody about history? And so I think different communities are likely going to come to different decisions about what to do. Some people are going to argue that you take down monuments, that you move them to museums where they can be discussed in a historical context, or you leave them in the place that they were so people understand these got put up for specific reasons and specific times. But then you also put up, as Jim suggested, other things to kind of tell us what the new sort of our new understanding of history is. So plaques to provide extra context, new statues to kind of put statues in conversation with one another. I mean, all of these things I think are viable options that need to be debated. But I think the idea that things could that we should try to either whitewash history by forgetting that it happened completely, or that we should try to whitewash history and try to ignore the motivations behind putting those things up, I think are both wrong.
You know what? We even need to bring Sheffield Hale, the president of the History Center, Atlanta History Center, because he would share your thinking. And in fact, he's offered some really important guidelines for doing just what you're talking about. But let me, Todd and Howard, let me read you something that was published in The Hill today, just to give us a sense of the scope of these monuments, okay? Here's what their survey shows. There are currently at least 1,503 remaining symbols of the Confederacy in public spaces, including 109 public schools named after prominent Confederates, many with African-American student populations, more than 700 Confederate monuments and statues on public property throughout the country, most of them, of course, in the South, 96 monuments in Virginia, 90 Georgia, 90 North Carolina. There are 10 U.S. military bases named in honor of Confederate military leaders, and it goes on. So they are primarily in the South, but Howard and Todd, this is a lot. There's a lot out there that as this debate goes on and on endlessly, people have to look at what they want to do with them, you know?
Well, I share some geographical history with Andra. I went to law school at Washington and Lee in Lexington, Virginia. And over the last several years, there's been a lively debate about the legacy of the two namesakes. And, you know, a couple years ago, they removed some Confederate flags from the chapel and this and that. Mm. The president of the university sent out an email to the alumni and everybody earlier this week saying that, you know, let us be clear from my perspective that this university is named after the two men for their roles connected with this university, and Lee having been president of the university. And the problem is when we start talking about removing this, removing that, two things happen. One is that we lose the ability to talk about somebody's virtues without having to completely denigrate them due to their vices, due to bad opinions they may have held at the time. And every historical figure you can name, I think, did something or held some belief that somebody would find repugnant today. We can't simply say he did this great thing or she did this great thing. And the second thing is for those who continue to like these monuments or this or that, it now becomes some reflection that they're a bigot or they're filled with some kind of hatred when that's not necessarily the case.
Okay, but Howard, there was a really interesting article, and I'm frankly forgetting it was the Washington Post or the New York Times the other day. May have been an online publication. And the headline was, why are there no statues for Nazi leaders and Adolf Hitler in Germany? And that seems like that's chilling to think about, but that's history.
It is. But the situation is entirely different. And this is what makes the Southern American history so odd. In the days after World War II, you had an occupying force. The U.S. was there with every weapon that you could possibly want.
Well, there
want.
Was an occupying force
and
here.
And they dictated the terms under which the history of the World War II began to be written. In the South, you basically had a federal abdication of that role.
All right.
Okay, and not only that, the curriculum in Germany requires that you learn the Holocaust in ways that we debate here. I mean, we have a state legislator here who's still arguing about whether or not slavery was the cause of the Civil War, who's a former high school teacher. And so those German students have a sense of what happened. They don't necessarily need to see that memorabilia. And there's this recognition that it's harmful and hurtful. We didn't have that same type of discussion, and we don't teach history in the same way.
Howard, yeah, before we take a break, you get in here.
Well, yeah. I think Andre's making the right point, in my opinion. I think some understanding that is universally agreed to is what's missing in this conversation. And I think it operates differently in different countries, but I think that's what's missing. And I think even the comments you made earlier about whether or not the actions follow the intentions of the folks who want to either remove or move to museums these statues, it's something that needs to be discussed.
Well, we're going to take a break. And as we go to break, I just make one comment based on my thoughts about this, which is it is so telling about how this country cannot resolve its debate and its struggle over our past, the slave past, that in 2017, every time something happens like Charlottesville, we go back to that debate about Confederate memorials. And it just, to me, it represents the larger issue that we have not figured out a way to talk about race.
To your point, I think race, obviously, but I think also we haven't had a government that's wanted to resolve that. I think you've got several individual stakeholders who want to do so, but not the government at large.
All right, we got to get a break in. We're running late on that. So let's do that real quickly. We'll come back. We'll finish up this conversation because there was an interesting story on the front page of the Constitution today. There are some descendants of important Confederate leaders who are all for getting rid of the monuments.
GPP's Fall Fund Drive is right around the corner, but don't wait to do your part. Your support now at gpb.org will give the campaign a strong start and keep the programs you enjoy coming to you. You'll also have a chance to win a getaway for two at the King & Prince Beach and Golf Resort on St. Simon's Island with oceanfront accommodations for three nights. Our thanks to the King & Prince for this opportunity, and thanks for your support now at gpb.org.
Thank you for choosing Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network of GPB. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching. I'm Ellen Reinhart. Thank you for listening.
Here we are. Oh, we are back.
Surprise.
Thank you, Olivia. I appreciate that. Back with Howard Franklin. Say hello, because you know what? Sometimes people say to us, we're not quite sure we hear the
Who's
voice.
Talking? Right. Howard Franklin, you got me here.
Todd Rehm.
Oh, good. Very good. Could you spell that last name for us?
R-E-H-M.
And Dr. Andre Gillespie.
Hello.
And of course, Jim.
And here's Galloway. Me, yes.
Just quickly to finish off that segment, the vice president of the Confederacy was a Georgia boy, Alexander H. Stevens. He was from out in Monroe or near Athens, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And today, in your newspaper, Jim, Ernie Suggs had a piece saying he did not have children himself. So the closest relatives he has are descendants through his family. Mm-hmm. Today, the paper reported that his great-great-great-grandnephews say it's time to change history. They've written a letter to the governor asking two things. One, there's a statue of their great-great-great uncle in Statuary Hall in Washington. We've discussed on this show the fact that states choose who they're going to place in that hall.
They get two choices.
Right. They get two statues, and he's one of them. They want the governor to take that statue out of Statuary Hall, and they want any statue relating to him and to the Confederacy removed, which is interesting.
It's interesting, and it's unusual, yeah. and it's this. You were just asking before the break. Where are the people who have reached across the divide? Well, here you are. You've got two.
And it should be noted that descendants of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson have also supported taking down
statues. Yes, that's right. Last week we saw stories about that. Okay, let's go to the extreme, the silly extreme of all this. ESPN found itself in enormous hot water because they had one of their play-by-play guys, whose name is Robert Lee. Robert Lee was scheduled long ago to call the University of Virginia football game, and they pulled him off because his name is Robert Lee. Would anyone like to tell us what nationality Robert Lee is?
He's Asian American.
He's an Asian American. So this thing goes from, I mean, really hard, tough, meaningful debate to just the silliest stuff, Andra.
Yeah, and as a UVA grad, I think this is not just that. As a person, I think this is stupid. you know, it's funny. Last year, I had the opportunity to work on a project with a guy named David Duke, and I remembered asking him about his name. And he was just like, I'm not that dude. And so I, you know, am proud, and I'm going to treat people with respect. I know I am not that person, and I'm just going to be confident in who I am.
But I will tell you what, to me, the ESPN move, yes, it was extremely silly, but it was also kind of an indication that major corporations out there don't know where the dialogue is going.
Well, the other thing about it, Todd and Howard, is that it was bowing to the understanding of the power of social media. One of the things ESPN apparently was afraid of was that people were going to start tweeting about how offensive it was that a guy named after the Confederate president, and so it's a recognition of the power of social media.
And I think it's a recognition of the fear of the power of social media.
Yeah, right. Well, exactly.
I think that fear has begun to drive a lot of business decisions of companies trying to just say, that's not our thing. We're going to stay away from it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, just to put a period on all of this, Monday, We will watch the unveiling of the statues at 10 o'clock on the Capitol grounds. The governor will speak.
It's also, I think, the 54th anniversary of King's I have a dream speech, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, thank you for that. We play just we'll play a little bit of it on Monday's show, actually. Let's move on to some national news, if we can. Jim, on Wednesday, you, Charles Richardson of the Macon Telegraph, and I had a chance to interview Arizona Senator, Republican Senator Jeff Flake. He's been the most outspokenly critical guy, Republican on the Hill, in terms of President Trump. Trump has reciprocated. He's attacked him repeatedly. And, you know, I think we both came away from that conversation thinking, well, it was an interesting conversation. Flake's a fascinating guy. I'm not sure that I realized when I asked him the final question of the interview that he'd never been asked it before.
Well, I think he probably has. I think he may have just answered it in another way. And you got to remember, I mean, just to excuse ourselves here, we're not on the Jeff Flake beat. We're not there keeping track
right,
of what he
exactly.
says day in day,
right.
day in day
but,
out.
But the point is, what I asked him, we're going to play the exchange, but we're going to play it because the New York Times, we were all over the national news this week. I mean, it was AP moved the story, CNN, we're going to play a little excerpt from Morning Joe this morning in which they played it and then talked about it. So we got an enormous amount of national attention, and I wanted to bring it up today, partly because I think it's great we did, but also because then I want to get your response to what Flake said. So to put this in context, what you're going to hear now is a clip of me asking Flake this question. Willie Geist was hosting the show this morning. He set it up. And then when we come out of the what you'll hear, Geist turns to Howard Dean, former DNC chair, former presidential candidate, and former governor of Vermont, for his thoughts.
Do you think the president's going to get a primary opponent in 2020 the way things are headed right now? And then we'll let you go.
You know, I don't know. I think that certainly depends on him. I think he could govern in a way that he wouldn't. But I think that the direction he's headed right now, just kind of drilling down on the base rather than trying to expand the base, I think he's inviting one.
Governor Dean, just think about the fact that anyone's even asking that question right now in a radio show of a sitting United States senator, that that's even in the atmosphere about Donald Trump.
Who knows if Trump is going to be around in 2020? I think this is unpredictable. I do think that if Jeff Flake doesn't win his primary, the Democrats have got a great shot at picking up that seat.
All right, Todd, do you think Jeff Flake is speaking words that are not to be spoken out loud? And is he right that there's trouble ahead for President Trump?
I think that for a good 9 months or better than that, there has been a fear among traditional politicians of the Trump electorate. And one of the things that happens, though, is if you see somebody surviving it, getting into a scrape and surviving it electorally, I think that's going to be a major change in the tone of the debate, is if one of these senators gets attacked by the president during a reelection campaign and survives it.
Yeah. We've got
Heller, all the gloves are going to come
right,
off.
We've got Heller in Nevada. We've got Flake in Arizona. And yes, right.
But the other side of it is if your reelection looks like it's going to be you against Donald Trump, well, why not pick a bigger fight?
Yeah, well.
And if you're going to get the downside of that, just throw the dice.
So everybody, Flake is struggling in the polls in Arizona now. And the reverse side of it, if he loses, I think he puts fear back into the hearts of Republicans in Congress, period, who are going to end up having to face reelection.
But much, much worse things have been said about the fate, potentially, of Donald Trump than getting a primary in 3 years, right? We've talked about him being impeached. We've talked about, him not being a legitimate president in the first place. Granted, not many of those things have been said by members of his party.
We are not using the word impeach on this show because it is unfortunate. I mean, It's so far-fetched, isn't it, Howard?
Fair enough.
Come on.
But it's been talked about like as if
the,
it's not.
It's like the MSNBC pipe dream.
Right. I mean, so, you know, there is this hesitation on the part of Republicans in terms of how to deal with President Trump and to realize or to try to figure out how strong his base is to see whether or not you have the wherewithal to be able to stand up against him. You know, on the other hand, there is something for, and I understand that this isn't the most strategic thing in the world, but to stand up for what is right, no matter what the consequences are. And, you know, let's say Jeff Flake were to lose and he goes down kind of as a martyr for standing up to the Trump administration. He won't have a seat, but he'll probably have some admirers in that respect. And the other thing probably to go along with that is, you know, the question is interesting, but it's a question that in some ways I thought was a foregone conclusion, because every time I see John Kasich on TV, I assume he's doing that to beat him run for office in 2020.
Yeah, but what's interesting is that Kasich, there's talk now that Kasich is in talks with Hickenlooper, the governor of Colorado, to have a kind of a bipartisan ticket, which I think is... I think it's rather foolish. It reminds me of the Bloomberg Sam Nunn ticket that was talked about so many years ago.
What Andre just said highlights to me the difference between an academic and those of us those of us who get judged on our win-loss record. In that, to me,
let's frame that a little differently.
In other words, Andre
is thinking about women and men of conscience and principle. You're talking about winning
wins
elections
and losses,
and that is a difference in what we do, and the idea of going down on principle or but pops into my mind.
But I'll tell you, look, we're just 14 months too early, because the question of whether Trump will have a primary opponent is going to be decided on the first Tuesday of November.
Of course it is, but the fact that it is being discussed, the fact that there are Republicans talking quietly about this, and you know it's more than John Kasich and Jeff Flake, you know that there are other Republicans who are thinking about this. I mean, that is a telling thing. But here's what's not 18 months down the road, Jim Galloway. That's a special election for the U.S. Senate next door in Alabama, where former judge Roy Moore, Supreme Court judge, is going to face the Trump candidate in that runoff.
Yeah, but it's a little bit foggy, because not only Luther Strange, the Republican incumbent, is not only the Trump candidate, the Trump choice, but he's also Mitch McConnell's choice. And so now you've got Steve Bannon over at Breitbart trying to pump up Judge Moore. So Steve Bannon has a twofer there. He gets to go after a Trump trophy and a McConnell trophy.
I was thinking of it in a little bit different context, Andre, which is if Roy Moore, who is, I recognize he has a base, clearly he does, or he wouldn't have come in first in the first election for that seat. Nevertheless, to many people in Alabama, he's toxic. I mean, this is the guy who wouldn't remove who insisted against court orders on keeping the Ten Commandments block that he put in the court and was thrown off the bench because of it. Then instructed judges across the state to not honor gay marriage, to not marry gay people after the Supreme Court ruling, and once again was removed. Yes, the people of Alabama reelected him after the first time, but to many people, he is toxic, and there's at least a possibility that a Democrat could win Jeff Sessions' seat.
Well, I have friends who, you know, are Democratic operatives in the state, and so they certainly realize that, you know, while it's definitely not guaranteed, that they have some hopes, you know, in the Democratic candidate, because he's a U.S. attorney and, you know, is a polished candidate. I mean, I think the issue, there are two things that are actually really interesting with this in terms of, you know, the Bannon versus Trump type of thing. So Trump tried to hedge his bets a little bit before the primary, saying, you know, he was excited about them both. And even though he had actually endorsed Strange, when it turned out that Strange came in second place, he was still trying to act like he supported both of them and he would be fine with whatever was going on. And so that actually lends itself to a question of whether or not Trump can actually outmaneuver Bannon. And so we'll actually get to see who the puppet master is as a result of this. But I think the issue with Moore, at least as far as Republican Party politics is concerned, is whether or not he can be disciplined, because he's got this track record of kind of going rogue all the time. And he'll say it's going rogue on his cultural principles, but, you know, that's not necessarily something that I think Mitch McConnell is going to welcome.
I wonder if he's going to, All right, we got to get in our last break for the show. Let's do that. When we come back, there are a couple things we really want to talk about here. One of them is Trump insisting and doubling down on the notion that he'll shut down the government if he doesn't get money for his wall. We'll talk a little bit about that after the break.
Two marches planned in the Bay Area this weekend are expected to draw white nationalists. Parents and teachers are having frank conversations with young people who want to counter-protest.
In Charlottesville, a number of folks were trying to protest nonviolently, and then violence occurred. So if you're choosing to not participate, that also makes a lot of sense.
Youth Radio this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is this afternoon from 4 till 7 on GPB.
Couple times this week, as we return on Political Rewind with Jim Galloway, Andra Gillespie, Todd Rehm, and Howard Franklin, a couple times this week, President said, I'm going to shut down the government if I don't get the down payment, $1 billion+ on my wall. In the one of the rare press briefings yesterday, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked about it. Here's what she said.
Sir, the president promised over and over again during the campaign that Mexico would pay for the wall. So why is he now threatening a government shutdown if Congress would pay for it?
The president's committed to making sure this gets done. Again, this is something the president's committed to. He's committed to protecting American lives, and doing that through the border wall is something that's important. It's a priority, and we're moving forward with it.
But he's not saying that Mexico is going to pay for it.
He hasn't said they're not either.
He hasn't said they're not either. There you go. Team, respond.
So, I mean, I think this is the instance of Trump thinks he's fulfilling a promise and that his constituents are taking him seriously, but not literally. And so the whole part about getting Mexico to pay for it was a nice sort of like campaign ringer, because he had the call and response thing going on with that. I think he thinks that his base doesn't care how the wall gets built so long as it gets built.
Yeah, but Galloway... Andra may have a point in terms of his constituency, but they've got a huge agenda that they need to pass up there. They've got the budget. They've got they've got to move on the debt ceiling. They've got the tax. I mean,
they're going to need somewhat tame Democrats in order to get all that done.
So how does this throw a monkey wrench into all of
the
that?
The biggest monkey wrench you can imagine. I mean, this is a Democrat's dream. I hope that he sticks with this and shuts down the. Just
no,
imagine.
No, you don't. See. You know,
I got a daughter that needs pay.
It won't last for long, but the idea that how many people are going to be impacted by this silly campaign promise that, as Andra said, most people thought this was just something cute he was throwing in there as he was talking about the wall. The idea that he would actually stick to this and shut down the government behind it it's incredible.
Okay, Todd, you're the Republican in the room.
I'd actually kind of forgotten about that whole thing. not having heard it on constant play, you know, replay for 9 months, I'd completely forgotten about it. And I guess I assumed everybody in Washington had forgotten
about
it.
You mean that Mexico's going to pay for the wall?
And you know what?
I'd forgotten about the wall.
I would agree with Todd. I would say that a lot of people had until... Healthcare repeal did not happen.
That's
until
right.
Obamacare repeal did not happen.
Yeah, I mean, apparently the news reporting on this is that one of the last things Bannon said to Trump before he exited the White House was, you had better get that wall funded, because after the healthcare debacle, the promise you made to repeal Obamacare went down in flames, you better make this thing happen to please your constituents. Doesn't that seem right to you, Todd?
It does, but I'm as shocked as anyone that if Donald Trump is taking Steve Bannon's parting words as something he ought to follow. I mean, it sounds like there's a lot more bad blood between them in the last couple days. And, you know, at some level, I kind of feel like if you don't like what's going on with this stuff in Washington, just wait. Just wait it out.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is – you know, if Bannon did suggest that, it was because it's something tangible that people can point to. And so even if nothing else happens, they can at least kind of point to that. It's no different than in urban politics where the mayor builds up downtown and says, I've done something, even if the neighborhoods have gone to pot. But, you know, one of the things that I think is actually really interesting about this, just from a civics lesson standpoint, and so this is my prep for my lesson in a couple of weeks, is that President Trump's suggestion that this should have been added to the VA bill so that it could have easily passed is crazy. You don't. Like, this is why amendments are treacherous, because they could totally reshape a bill and scuttle, like, the primary, like, you know, motivation behind, like, sponsoring that bill in the first place from getting passed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was just really interested from a civic standpoint.
I think Andra makes a really good point. Here's this big VA bill that's a bipartisan effort, Johnny Isaacson being one of the people very involved in that. People all want to support the veterans. So for the president to suggest that if you threw the this into the mix.
Now, was he throwing the wall, or was it the debt ceiling?
It was the debt ceiling.
Oh, debt ceiling. Sorry.
No, that's fine, but it's still part of the same thing. That he's got an agenda. He's got to get a debt ceiling, ceiling rate. And it does show the president's naivete, to say the least.
That's exactly right. Proof that he doesn't understand how Washington works, and that the question is, at what point does he actually pull the trigger on one of these crazy campaign promises and go further than he means to go with a tweet storm or with a promise in front of a podium? And when he does that, I think that's when, you know, all hell breaks loose.
All right.
And I think, you know, Steve, they talk about Steve Bannon thriving on chaos. And if you wanted to see additional gasoline poured onto Washington, D.C., that probably would have been what you did.
Can we change the – it's Friday. We're almost out of time. Could we just lighten things up a little bit? Because it's been another hard week in politics, hasn't it been? I don't know about you, whether you – well, I guess if you really are a big Trump supporter, you probably do not like the fact that Alec Baldwin is back. Saturday Night Live is doing these Thursday night weekend updates. And Baldwin last night reemerged as President Trump. And we thought we'd play just a little of it for you.
We take you live to the Phoenix Convention Center, where President Donald Trump is just about to take the stage.
Thank you, Phoenix. First, I want to talk about Charlottesville. As we all know, there was a tragic victim that came out of Charlottesville, me. Folks, the media has treated me so unfairly by reporting my entire remarks, even the bad ones. They won't tell you about my accomplishments, but I've done so much. First off, last night, I solved Afghanistan. Solved! I sat down with our military, we looked at the map, and I asked the hard questions like, which one is Afghanistan? Is that blue thing an ocean? We're doing so much. We're doing so much, folks. Like the wall. We all love the wall, don't we? Yeah. Who's going to pay for it?
Mexico!
That's right. You are the American taxpayer.
All right. So, Jim, you know, here's one of the things I think is sort of interesting about it. All of the late-night comics are just dining out on Trump night after night. Stephen Colbert especially, and Seth Meyer has actually been so effective in his satire about the president that their ratings have shot up. And here's what I think is kind of interesting about all this. There was a time in the past when a candidate for president, if she or he became the fodder for late night jokes, we thought, boy, this can have an impact on how they're viewed by the American people. We are so divided now that half of us are laughing like crazy, and Republicans who love Trump are talking about the culture wars where those liberal comics are trashing him.
I'm recalling the time when political joke boundaries were set by Johnny Carson.
Yeah. I know, you know what, I'm curious what you all think about that.
So, well, I'm going over my head work that has been done about this. And so, you know, and there's certain comics who, you know, have definitely sort of tried to take the middle road. And so, you know, somebody actually counted the jokes and on partisan sides for Jay Leno in particular. And he usually kind of came down, you know, down the middle. I think that the tough thing is that Donald Trump is a shiny object, and so people are going to be drawn to it. And so for any candidate, or any politician, they tend to kind of become the butt of certain types of jokes, the more interesting they are. So if you've got a peccadillo about you, so people are going to joke about Monica Lewinsky for Bill Clinton, because that's definitely much more interesting than, you know, anything that, you know, a Republican opponent at the time would do. And so for Donald Trump, because he just does this every day, and in part because he also came out of entertainment, and so he still sort of thinks about the, you know, any news is good news type of thing, it's not surprising that people have kind of been drawn to it.
Well, I think President Trump, in some ways, has proven that any mention is good. But the other side of it is that there is no comparable Democratic figure, either in terms of the outrageousness or in terms of the stature. You
right.
know, they don't have somebody to beat up on that side who is an instantly recognizable name, or whom you could caricature and have people recognize.
Yeah, which may be, Howard, a bad thing for Democrats right now.
For the time being, that's the case. But I go back to, you know, what you guys said earlier. Yes, this man is an entertainer. Yes, he is eminently and infinitely interesting. But yes, he says something that's incredibly stupid or backwards or contradictory nearly every 24 hours.
Yes, but Howard, I wanted to ask you to respond to what Todd's point. I get your point on that, but Lisa Murkowski is not rich fodder for the late night comments.
No, but comparison to Trump, who is?
The problem here is that every minute after 9 o'clock, your audience becomes younger and thus more Democratic. Right here. But the other part of this is that you've also seen the rise of alternative venues for conservative comedians, specifically on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I just wanted, really, that was just Todd.
I'm going to have to ask Jim to send me some links to these conservative comedians, because that has for decades been one of my complaints about my fellow righties, is that too few of us have a sense of humor. I think P.J. O'Rourke was the last one with a real sense of humor.
All right. P.J. O'Rourke gets the last mention on today's show, because we're just about out of time. Howard Franklin, Todd Rehm, Andre Gillespie, Jim Galloway, thank you so much for the conversation, a thoughtful conversation today. Jim, are you going to be at the Capitol Monday when the governor speaks?
Bells on, very, very early, because it's going to be a tightly controlled area. It's high security.
Yeah, so that ceremony starts, I think, at 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock.
You'll be there, which is great, because you can come back and talk to us about what you saw. And as I said earlier, Sam Whitehead from GPB News, we'll be there, and we'll invite him to come in. Anybody else going down there for this? It's a big day. Howard?
Watching the live stream.
Okay, fine. That's right. That's an important thing we should point out, that you can watch this live. And I mention that because, Andra, this is a long overdue but truly historic moment. The first African-American being recognized with a statue on the lawn of the Capitol. That is a hopeful sign in a time of politics that is really troubling to
yes.
many people.
Yeah, no, I actually like Jim's sort of phrasing that the procrastination was providential.
All right. Thank you all so much for being here. Thanks to Olivia Rheingold, to Jenny Ament, to Tyler Morris for your work on today's show, and always on Political Rewind. We're back Monday at 2. Of course, in the meantime, if you can't be near the radio, you can subscribe to the Political Rewind podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And Jim Galloway will have this show posted in the next, I guess, maybe couple of hours, although you got a column deadline. But eventually it'll be on the Political Insider blog. You can tell your friends, that's where they can
on
hear
Politically
it.
Georgia.
Okay. Thank
too.
You, Jim Galloway. See you all. Everybody have a great weekend. We'll be back here Monday at 2.